WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Let's think about the race for First Lady. There won't be one if Jerry Brown wins the Democratic presidential nomination, but if Bill Clinton is the Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton and Barbara Bush will be campaigning on drastically different First Lady platforms. Barbara's a traditionalist. Hillary's a reformer. Maureen Carrigan has just finished a novel about political spouses called The Candidate's Wife by Patricia O'Brien. Maureen says this novel makes it clear that any woman who actually wants to be First Lady ought to be disqualified on the grounds of insanity.
Here's a Washington insider story for you. An old student of mine works in a posh Georgetown jewelry store. One day, a very stylish older woman came in and bought some silver bracelets. She paid for the bracelets by check, and when my old student asked for some ID, this woman drew herself up stiffly and announced, "I'm Mrs. Lloyd Benson." Well, lots of political wives fall into this Mrs. category. Mrs. Pat Buchanan, what is her first name anyway? And Barbara Bush. Even though we know her first name, she's also struck a deal to stand by her man in return for basking in his reflected glory. The other kind of political wife, Rosalind Carter, Nancy Reagan, is the one who tries to assert herself. She's always labeled a hungry power freak. It's fascinating right now to watch Hillary Clinton try to navigate between these two traditional political wife images and make an independent role for herself. So far, she's not doing too good. She's offended Tammy Wynette and the career cookie bakers. And the latest rumor is that she's been angling for a position in her husband's cabinet. If Hillary doesn't start effacing herself soon, Barbara Bush will squash her with that same coy phrase she used to describe Geraldine Ferraro in the 1988 election. It's a word that rhymes with witch and begins with a B. Meow, meow. Hillary should take a break, kick back, and read Patricia O'Brien's novel, The Candidate's Wife. O'Brien would console her with the rueful truth that even if a candidate wins by a landslide, his wife will always find herself in a no-win position. The candidate's wife is a thumping good political potboiler. O'Brien's story focuses on Kate Goodspeed, loyal wife of Democratic and Catholic presidential candidate Luke Goodspeed. With a name like that, how can he lose? Well, maybe by having an affair with his beautiful deputy campaign manager. Then there's the little issue of abortion. Kate is pro-choice. Luke manages to remain neutral until Kate blunders into a public fight about abortion with a Catholic cardinal. Throw in the Goodspeed's pregnant teenage daughter and their suicidal chief campaign aide, and you've got big election problems, bigger than, say, not inhaling a joint. O'Brien served as press secretary for part of Michael Dukakis's disastrous presidential campaign, so she writes with intimate knowledge about how the Goodspeed's lives become nothing more than a series of media moments, and how their political compromises threaten to destroy their identities. She's also insightful about the payoff Kate gets for playing the role of Mrs. Candidate for President. "It's a thrill," Kate tells her sister. "When I hear the applause after Luke talks, and I know we built the ideas together, I feel the applause is for me, too." Sure it is. Kate learns painfully that she can't go on living with her ego transplanted into the body of another person, and she becomes a more outspoken kind of candidate's wife. But let's face it, nothing's really going to change until we have a few novels entitled The Candidate's Husband.
Maureen Carrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Candidate's Wife by Patricia O'Brien. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. This morning we lost one of our most popular and most prolific science fiction writers. Isaac Asimov died of heart and kidney failure at the age of 72. He had cut back on his writing earlier this year after a prostate operation. When Asimov started writing science fiction in the 1930s, he didn't expect that fantasies like space travel and nuclear power would be realities in his lifetime. Throughout his life, he kept looking ahead, projecting what life might be like in the future. Asimov leaves us with over 350 books of science fiction and science fact. He emigrated with his parents to America from the Soviet Union in 1923 when he was 3 years old. The family settled in Brooklyn, New York. As a child, he loved reading science fiction magazines. His first story was published in the magazine Amazing Stories in 1939, 1 week after Asimov's 19th birthday. I spoke with Isaac Asimov in 1987 and asked him what those early science fiction magazines were like.
Those early magazines were larger than the magazines, the science fiction magazines of nowadays. Some were actually the size of the Slicks, the Sat Evening Post, things like that. Usually they're made of cheap paper with rough edges. They paid a half cent a word to a cent a word. And the only way you could possibly make a living out of this pulp fiction was to write a great deal and quickly and without undue revision. And I learned how to do that in those days. I thought that was the way to write. I didn't know any better. And I've kept that up ever since. And so as a result, I now have published 366 books, and I'm making a good living out of it.
Now, you coined the term robotics in a story that I think you wrote in 1942.
That's right. The story was called Runaround. And I had someone refer to the three laws of robotics, and that was in fact, I think they called them three rules the first time I mentioned them. But that was the first time the word robotics was ever used in print in the English language, and I get the credit for it in the Oxford English Dictionary.
That must be a thrill.
Yeah, two other words also I get the credit for.
Oh, really? Which ones?
One is psychohistory, which I was the first to use in my Foundation series, and the other is positronic, which I was the first to use in connection with my robots.
Would you review the three rules of robotics that you came up with?
Well, I eventually called them three laws. Number one is a robot may not harm a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Second law is a robot must obey orders given it by a human being, except where that would conflict with the first law. And the third is a robot must protect its own existence, except where that would conflict with the first or second laws.
Now, these were rules for robot designers?
That's right. And as a matter of fact, they're taken seriously. In other words, a great many of the early people who worked in robotics were more or less inspired by my robot stories, and they knew the three laws, and they realized that if they could develop robots that obeyed them, that would be great. So far, the robots we have are still extremely simple computerized levers. They're not complex enough to have the three laws built into them.
What were the robots that you envisioned in the 1940s when you were writing this story?
Well, they were typical robots that we used in science fiction. They were made of metal, and they had a roughly humanoid shape. My contribution was that they were designed with safeguards. That's what the three laws were. Until my robots came in, mostly what robot stories consisted of was robots being built and then destroying their creators. It was the Frankenstein story told over and over and over and over again. And I took the attitude that robots would be machines, and that one of the chief concerns of those who built them was to make it impossible for them to do harm. That apparently struck everyone as sensible, because after my stories became popular, the old-fashioned robot stories disappeared, and the new kinds of robot stories, even when they didn't quote my laws, which, of course, they didn't like to because they were mine, they simply assumed they existed, and so did the readers.
You know, for years you've really been writing more science than you have science fiction. How come?
Oh, well, until 1958, I wrote mostly science fiction. But then when Sputnik went up and everyone in the United States got scared that we were falling behind in science, I felt it was absolutely necessary for anyone who knew science and could write to try his hand at educating the American public. So I deliberately stopped writing science fiction, mostly, and started writing science books. And that went on for 21 years, and then Doubleday got tired. And they said they wanted me to go back to writing science fiction novels. And they were very persuasive. And so I wrote Foundation's Edge, which was a continuation of the old Foundation series that I'd written 30 years earlier. And it hit the bestseller list, stayed on for 25 weeks. To my intense surprise, it was my 262nd book. And until then, I thought I had a perfect score, you know, that I knew exactly how to miss the bestseller list. I'd done it 261 times in a row, and flopping on the 262nd surprised me. But after that, Doubleday wouldn't be stopped. They wanted a novel every year, and I've been writing them, and they've been doing very well, I'm glad to say, because they're hard to do.
You know, your book, Fantastic Voyage, reminded me in a way of an essay that you wrote a few years ago about a triple heart bypass that you had. And in that essay, you described having an angiogram, which is where they basically inject dye into an artery so that they could monitor the flow of blood through the heart. And you had the option of watching the angiogram on the video screen that your heart was being monitored on, but you wrote that you turned your head and you didn't want to watch it.
No, I didn't.
For the author of Fantastic Voyage, describing all these scientists journeying through the body's bloodstream, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but, you know, it's like that old statement saying that the management is not responsible for the views expressed in this program. Well, I'm the management, and I'm not responsible for the views presented in my stories. I travel all over the galaxy. In real life, I hate to travel, and I never go in airplanes. When I wrote a book called The Human Body, I described every conceivable disease and bad working that I could think of without a shudder. But in real life, I'm very queasy.
Well, now we could get to your fear of planes. For someone who wrote about a spacewalk before astronauts actually landed on the moon, yet you were afraid to fly planes. That's quite a paradox.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm afraid to fly them. I just
don't trust
never
them.
Got into the habit of it, that's all. And now it's too late. I just don't want to. But that's part of a bigger problem. I just hate to travel by any means. I like to stay where I am. I never leave Manhattan voluntarily. And I don't know why that is. It's, when I'm forced to travel, it doesn't bother me very much. It's just that I happen to like it at home.
You once wrote that we should not see science or technology as inevitable destroyers or saviors. Does that kind of sum up your view of technology?
That's right. It's technology is neutral. That is, it depends on how it's used. It's up to us to use it wisely or foolishly. And often our intentness on immediate gain, on short-term goals, causes us to use it foolishly without due regard for the long-term harm we might do. And that's sad, of course, but on the other hand, it's understandable. It's very difficult for human beings to take the long view and to give up the immediate profit.
With that said, are there any breakthroughs or inventions that you really would like to see happen?
Oh, I want to see how. I want to have people find out just how the brain works. And that, to me, is the most important conceivable problem to be solved in the world. And on a lesser scale, I would like to see a space-centered society. I want to see the human range extended. I want to see mining stations on the moon, and huge settlements in orbit around the Earth. I would like to see power plants in orbit and factories. I would like to see as much as possible of Earth's industrial plant moved into space so that we don't foul our own nest with waste products. Of course, people say, well, then we'll just foul space, but space is much larger. And space has an automatic cleaning device called the solar wind, so that things might be better up there. Oddly enough, the pollution of space is not so much the ordinary chemical wastes and all that. It's the fragments of satellites that are beginning to worry people, because they stay in orbit. Billions and countless billions of little particles, sometimes just of paint, which are moving around at 5 miles a second, and which, when they strike, can can do damage even when they're very light. So we're going to have to figure out ways of sweeping up space, for instance.
If there were space colonies in your lifetime, would you dare to travel to them?
No, not me. Not me, but someone has to stay on Earth, and I volunteer.
Isaac Asimov died this morning at the age of 72. Our interview was recorded in 1987. Asimov's latest book was published this month, called Isaac Asimov's Complete Stories, Volume 2. This is Fresh Air.